When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. Now, as we wait for Ridley Scott's much-anticipated Napoleon film, if you're listening at the time of recording, it's out imminently. I think it's 2 days. I think it's November 22nd it comes out over here in the UK. Me and Matt are going to watch it in a few days' time, and we'll be bringing you our review next week. So stay tuned for that one. If you're listening post-release, then that's already out. Please go and listen to it. But we were thinking of a film we could do in the interim. We had a week to spare. And Matt messaged me one evening. He was going, Robbie, I'm watching quite an interesting flick. And I was like, oh, yeah, what are you watching, Matt? And Matt chose this week, it is 1976's...
Shout at the Devil.
Yeah. Now, it sounds like a horror film when you listen, when you hear the name, don't you?
A little bit,
yeah. But it's actually... it's actually an adventure film in many ways, an adventure war hybrid. So I'll get into production and we'll learn a little bit more about Shout at the Devil. So the film is based upon Wilbur Smith's novel of the same name that was originally released in 1968, with the film rights to a lot of Smith's books being bought at the time by British producer Michael Klinger. Now, he also bought the rights to Gold as well at the time. And Gold was another Moore-fronted movie. We'll get to cast later. That was released in 1974, and Klinger himself produced 1971's Get Carter, among other projects.
Ooh.
Yeah, and the film was directed by Peter R. Hunt, a British director, editor, and producer. His credits include, for editing, Killing Korea, Sink the Bismarck, HMS Defiant, Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, and the Ipcress File, to name a few.
Bloody hell.
I know, what a back catalogue there. And then he directed The Wild Geese 2, Gold, as previously mentioned, and in 1969, On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
He directed the best Bond film. Wow. I'm just throwing that out
there.
That's
going to cause some controversy.
I'm not going to die on that hill. But yeah, no, that's a cracking career.
What a back catalogue there. Yeah, I know, right? Some absolute classics in there. And the film was originally announced in 1969, but it took a hell of a long time to get funding. They originally wanted to use Cinerama, film in the Cinerama,
Format.
Yeah, sorry, film it in the Cinerama format. But that fell through, as at the time, I think American studios were apprehensive on sort of like projects that they weren't too sure that were going to be a hit, and they wanted hits. And I think Cinerama had some maybe financial issues around the time as well, so it just fell through. But the film was eventually put into production in the mid-70s, with Klinger himself calling it a combination of The African Queen and The Guns of Navarone. And I think that's a fair, fair comparison.
Not bad. Yeah.
It's essentially like, it's like three movies in one. So much happens in this, if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's freely available to watch on YouTube as well, which is great this week.
No idea how, but it's on one of those channels that uploads full films with tasty rips. They must have the license to it, because it's been up there for an awfully long time.
Yeah, exactly. Because this isn't, I mean, unless you're like a Moore aficionado or a Marvin aficionado, this one could just easily pass you by, I think.
Well, this is what I was thinking about when you were doing the intro. Like, we've done films with Moore and Marvin in the past, not together, but we've done them. And whenever we've done cast, we've always run down their various films. And this one's always been one that I've picked out of their films and gone, I've never seen that. That sounds like a romp. And it turns out it is.
No, it is. So. It really, really is. Cinematography was by Michael Reed, who worked as a camera operator at Hammer Films early in his career before going on to become a DOP on larger projects. He worked
on... you tell me he worked on Steel Bayonet, isn't it?
No.
Oh,
no, he didn't, unfortunately.
That would have been great.
He worked on 1959's Captured by John Krish, which is the Korean War prisoner of war movie that was made for the British military intelligence. And it was famously... It wasn't banned, but it was restricted for a long time. And there was a BFI release on Blu-ray a few years ago. I've got it in the FOF HQ film collection, and we are going to plan on doing that one soon, because that's a very interesting docudrama. Very interesting.
It's up on the Imperial War Museum.
It is. Yeah, it's on there now
as well, isn't it? Mm.
It's got Wilfred Bramble in it too, from Steptoe Son. Yeah, I won't do the impression I was thinking of doing it. I've been kept. No, I can't do it.
Carry on.
I will. And he would also go on to be a DOP on 23 episodes of The Saint. Nice little Moore reference there.
Nice link.
And on Her Majesty's Secret Service too.
Cool.
So some real friends calling upon friends in this one. The Mackenzie Break and Von Richthofen and Brown. So some good pedigree there. It was filmed on location in Malta and, very controversially, apartheid South Africa at the time. I know Moore was heavily criticised at the time because he'd done Gold a couple of years before. And then he would later go and shoot parts of The Wild Geese in South Africa too. So it was quite controversial at the time. With a shooting period of 15 weeks in mid-1975, the South African locations were shot in and around Port St. John. And the parts of the film are based on the sinking of SMS Königsberg in 1915. Very, very loosely, I might add. There's almost nothing to do with the First World War in this movie. It's kind of just shoehorned in right near the end.
War just gets declared and it just happens to be...
Yeah, they happen to read...
Because they're having their own private little war, aren't
they? They're having a private war, yeah. And they happen to read a memo about an hour and a half in, and they learn that a war's been declared. Which was, I quite enjoyed that, because I was like, oh yeah, they don't have telephones, not know where they were. The movie was produced by Tonav Films. This seems to be the only Tonav film produced. I think it was maybe a company-based setup to shoot this movie. And it was distributed in the UK by Hemdale Film Corporation and in the US by American International Pictures, who were owned by MGM at the time. 13th of April 76 released in the UK and 27th of November in the US. 50 minutes were cut from the original edit. And I think you can tell near the end there's quite a lot of cutting that seems to just happen. And a large sea battle between British and German warships was left out of the screenplay that's in the book due to budget restraints. And talking of budget, the film was shot for $9 million and it was a big success in the UK, earning $15 million at the box office. However, overseas, it only grossed $3 million US dollars. But that's a pretty decent return. I think they probably broke even.
Yeah.
And then after this, there's a bit of a souring between Klinger and Wilbur Smith. They were meant to create more movies based on Smith books. However, it all ended in litigation and I couldn't find any concrete information on that, but it did end a little bit sour. between the author and the producer. So we could have got more Smith films, but we just didn't. But the film was, again, controversial and derided upon release. There was a lot of sort of feeling that the movie had a lot of old... It just felt old to some people, and then some people couldn't get over the fact that it was shot in South Africa. There is an instance of blackface in this movie, which incredibly dates it, I must admit. I was kind of shocked to see it. But yeah, it's of its time, and we'll just say that now. The movie is very, very of its time. But anyway, our retro review this week comes from Roger Ebert, November 11th, 1976. And he says, "Shout at the Devil is a big, dumb, silly movie that's impossible to dislike. It's so cheerfully corny, so willing to involve its heroes in every possible predicament that after a while we relax. This is the kind of movie they used to make back when audiences were supposed to have the mentality of a 12-year-old, and it's great to be 12 again. The movie doesn't mess around. Marvin and Moore are well cast. Marvin plays the drunk with an exuberancy brought to the same role in Cat Ballou and Paint Your Wagon. Who else can roll his eyes so meaningfully over a bottle of gin? Moore is so proper, so reserved and detached that even in retreat, he seems to be strolling. Shout at the Devil isn't great cinema, but it's great fun."
I would agree with that. That's a solid review. It's interesting, isn't it? It kind of harks back to those classic adventure films in a lot of ways. But as we'll talk about later on, it has this startling flip change in tone.
Yeah.
About two-thirds of the way through. And I don't know about you, but I think the film, it works. And I think the film's the better for it because it removes it from being a straight adventure movie in a lot of ways. It adds a darker tone.
Yeah, it definitely gives you some stakes to cling on to near the end. When the movie kind of feels like it should be wrapping up, it ramps itself up a bit. And I did enjoy that. Mm. But what did you guys think? As always, we turn to you for the one-word reviews. You can find those on Twitter, now known as X, every Monday, Sunday before we record. Please get involved. So we start with World War II TV's Paul Woodage. He says, "Underrated. Eddie Bond goes with epic. Brian Williams goes with Fleischer. Ian McKellen says wunderbar. Martin W., proto-Bond. Tony Pollard, Königsberg. Joe Skinner says boozy. Military History Observer goes with Zanzibar. Pete the Paint, revenge. And Nick Karyovias goes with Boyzone. Mark F. goes with good. Barry North goes with Mohammed." More about him in the cast. And finally, we'll end with Andy Cambridge, who says fun. So I think the general consensus there is pretty on the level. I know some people said it. A couple of people said they didn't enjoy it, but I think this is one of those kind of movies, if you've seen it and you can accept it for what it is, I think you have a fun time.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those Saturday afternoon films.
Yeah,
almost. Yeah, it really is. Almost. But moving into cast, we've got Lee Marvin as Flynn Patrick O'Flynn, and he's a kind of...
What a name.
Yeah, he's a sort of philandering crook that is always on the lookout to make a fast buck. And the crux to the film at the beginning is that he ropes in Roger Moore's character to be the face of a ivory expedition into German territory. And he thinks that having a Brit along will... protect him from the wrath of the Germans.
It's hilarious.
So, you know, we've had ample Lee Marvin on the show over the years.
We have.
He began his career in the 50s. He was in Eight Iron Men in 1952. He was in the Glory Brigade in 1953. The Kane Mutiny in 54, Attack in 56. He was in The Professionals, which we've covered on the show, and Love in 1966. In 1967, of course, he was in The Dirty Dozen. He was Sergeant Riker in 68. He was in Hell in the Pacific. And then in 1980, he was in The Big Red One. And then finally, he was in a number of the Dirty Dozen sequels, And of course, in 1986, he was also in Delta Force with Chuck Norris, famously.
He was. How topical as we go into December. More on that soon, folks, if you're listening.
Kind of linked, but not really.
It's
anyway.
Tenuous. Yeah, that's all you're getting before you see the artwork, guys, on the socials. Keep your eye out. December's coming hot and fast.
Then we have our second lead, which is Roger Moore, who plays Sebastian Oldsmith, who is a aristocratic upper class Brit who
old Etonian type,
yeah is on his way to Australia to look after sheep because his family have bundled him away.
He's just taking a cushy job, isn't he?
Well, it seems so, doesn't it?
Yeah,
or at least what's been sold to him is one. He was in Ivanhoe, The Alaskans, Maverick and The Saint before becoming Bond in 1973. As Rob mentioned, he previously appeared in Gold. He was in The Wild Geese in 1978. He was in Escape to Athena in 1979. North Sea Hijack in the same year. Sea Wolves a year later. And in 1997, of course, he was in Spice World. Then we've...
I've got a great thing about Moore that I found. So this is from Ian Holmes' book, Acting My Life, from 2004. And there's another piece from it I want to say when Matt gets to Ian Holm. Mm-hmm. But apparently they were flying to a location... into the Kruger National Park in South Africa, and I'll read from here Ian's account. So he says, "We hit bad weather and we had to fly through cloud for 40 minutes or so, during which time the small plane bucked and reared alarmingly. Most of us were quiet and pensive, contemplating the worst, though willing it not to happen. But Moore squirmed and whimpered for most of the journey. Eventually he lay on his back and started to undo his trousers. Then his hand disappeared down the front of them. 'What the fuck are you doing, Roger?' snarled Marvin, who was accustomed to Roger's clowning around. 'If I'm going to heaven,' Moore replied. 'If the actor, I want to go with a smile on my face.'"
That's it's like he's in the room.
It's like it's in the room.
Incredible. Incredible.
that's not Roger Moore. That's Peter Sessions doing Roger Moore from
Yeah, of
from
course.
Stella
All
Street.
The best impressions are other people's impressions of someone else. I know.
I just thought that was incredible. Just like
what a story. Wow.
What a thing to happen.
Wow.
Does
Ian know whether Roger managed to achieve his aviation climax?
It just stops there. I assume them sort of judging him stopped them. I can't think Marvin would have allowed that to happen.
No, but apparently they got on quite well. They had a shared love of Jack Daniels, and Moore had some shipped in from Johannesburg to the actual shooting location, and they had a couple of cottages.
I'm making a little bit of money now, Marvin. I can get the Jack Daniels in on the Bond money.
He's got that Bond money. And they whiled away evenings together. So they apparently got on really well.
Mm.
But speaking of Roger and his... urges. We've got Barbara Parkins as Rosa O'Flynn, Rosa Oldsmith, and she is Roger's love interest in the film, who he marries and has a daughter with, or a child with, I forget. She was a Canadian-American actress. She began work in the early 60s, and she was in lots of film and TV roles, lots of guest appearances and that sort of thing over the years. Then we have Ian Holm as Mohammed, who is O'Flynn's mute servant.
Which is great.
The story goes that Mohammed was saved by O'Flynn from Fleischer after he was hung from a tree and left to die.
Right. Is that why he's obsessed with hanging people in the movie?
Yes.
I get it now.
He wants to hang the Askaris and the Germans.
Yeah, that part is hilarious.
And possibly some of the local tribes as well. Yeah. He has no issue with doing that.
No, it's chill, does he?
Wild, isn't
he? Ian just brings like such a levity to that role. Like I love how he's the comic relief in certain parts. It's just so good.
Always handing Leah gin.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. He just knows what he needs. I've got another great little. If you indulge me a moment, I've got another Holm. What's the word? Recollection. So, again, from Ian Holmes, Acting My Life. So Holm apparently took the role to escape his then-girlfriend, B, who admittedly he'd been having an affair with at the time. And she phoned him on set and said, "Your little ivory tower has collapsed. I know about your affairs, and I'm having one too." So upon learning this, Holm was really quite cut up. He was crying on set, really upset.
I'm having to reap what I've sown.
I know, exactly.
Terrible.
Yeah. My chicken's coming home to roost. So Marvin saw him crying, and apparently he said this, and I'll read verbatim. As I blubbed, Marvin gazed at me with the kind of blank, chilling hostility that was somehow softened by understanding and an inexpressible desire to be kind. He stroked my hair and said this, "Ian, let me tell you one thing. We all go through an awful lot of fucking in this life."
Amazing.
Holm was saying he was worried how Marvin would take it because he knew he was this like war hero turned like proper rugged actor, and he was like, I didn't want him to see me upset.
Oh,
it's just great.
Again, I would have loved to have had a drink with Lee Marvin.
Who wouldn't? Yeah.
Again, back to cast. Holm was in The Bofa's Gun in 1968. Oh, What a Lovely War, the year after. He was in March or Die, which we've done on the show in 1977. Yep. Famously, he was in Alien in 1979. He was Napoleon in Time Bandits in 1981.
Amazing.
He was inside the Third Reich, the HBO, I think, or the TV miniseries in 1982. Lord of the Rings, of course. And in 2005, he was in Lord of War with Nick Cage.
Yeah. A late actor. They died a couple of years ago. Shame to see him go.
Yeah.
One of the greats. Mm.
And then we have Herman Fleischer, who is played by René Kolderhoff, and he plays the German commander of the province, who is the main antagonist. Yeah. German actor, he actually began acting during the war in Germany. He was in lots of thrillers and film noir. He was also in Stalingrad, Dogs, Do You Want to Live Forever in 1959.
Wow.
At the Court Martial in the same year. The Atlantic Wall in 1970. Operation Daybreak in 1975. Soldier of Orange in 1977. And The Winds of War in 1983.
That's pretty much
rounds out cast. And yes, he does have quite a pretty interesting career in terms of... War movies.
He does. He plays a role like an evil version of Baron Bomburst in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That's the only thing I could think of when I was watching it.
Yeah,
like,
heavy vibes of that, yeah.
He's the colonial villain version of the Baron from Chitty Bang Bang.
Kept expecting an Ascari to walk behind him going like...
Yeah. It's great, though. He brings this sort of bumbling cartoonishness to the movie where...
Yeah.
I know you're not meant to take him seriously, but he's the big bad. It's very good.
And then again, he flips too, and it goes a little bit dark, and we'll talk about that in a moment.
Dark. It does get a bit dark.
But for now, I think it's time for the alley telling.
It is.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
It's time for Alley Tally on Fighting on Film.
Alley Tally this week, it's a pre-World War One that becomes a World War One movie, which is rare. We've not done that. And we've not done many films that have colonial troops in. So that was nice to see.
Yeah.
And they're armed with Martini Henry carbines, with Webleys in it, Vickers guns, cannons, biplanes. But for me, my favourite thing in the Alley Tally this week is Lee Marvin in a pith helmet with a 303 bandolier around his waist. When they sort of get to the more warrior parts, he just looks great. Like, It's just, it's Lee Marvin. Like, he doesn't look cool. Leon and Lee, exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure Matt will talk about it, but the section where he's drilling the colonial troops under his command, it's just a classic Lee scene. It's just so good.
Yeah, it's one of my faves. I might talk about that later on. But there's all sorts in this. There's hunting double rifles. The Germans have Gewehr 98s.
It's nice, yeah.
As you mentioned, there's a few Martini Henry carbines in the background, SMLEs as well. There's a German lieutenant who has a Luger. Fleischer himself blasts after Lee with a Mauser C96.
Brumandel. It's not a gun. It's a Brumandel Mauser.
Rosa has a Webley Mark 6. And she coldly dispatches a German prisoner with that.
She really, really blows him away. He doesn't show does. Him.
I think she puts all six in him.
I know.
The Lee that Lee has is a charger loading Lee Enfield, one of the long boys, not the short magazine Lee Enfield.
He has the stance that he uses in The Professionals to fire his repeater with. Of course, as we know from talking to Jim Dowdle a few months back, like Lee is the gun guy. Like he just is, you know, he's ex-US Marine. Like that's Lee. And it just never leaves him, does it? It's just so great to see.
Well, I'll talk about it now because he has that physicality of he just looks right behind a gun on screen. He just brings this physical presence to the way he handles guns on screen. And the bit that that Rob mentioned is he's training these fake Ascari he's going to send Roger off with into the tribal areas to rustle up some funds by collecting fake taxes.
Yes.
And
they give out the money though, don't they?
They do. They end up giving out the money. That's the part.
Yeah.
So Lee gives him like a chest that he's supposed to fill with some walking around money just to show that he's already collected some.
Yeah.
And he ends up that all the locals feign, you know, poverty and they're starving and such, and it just ends up with Roger giving away the money to the locals, which is great. But that scene where Lee's training the fake Ascari, and one of them accidentally puts a round through his gin bottle, great comic reaction from him,
and then he just
runs that charger loading Lee Enfield like a boss, and he just cleans house of.
I don't think that's six an targets. Extra. I think that's either Blank and the prop department, you know, making them explode, or that's Lee really shooting them. Like, I couldn't work it out.
I mean, he could do that, but it was probably Blank, just so they got it.
I think it probably was, but it just looks great, doesn't it? Like, you know, everyone with a rifle in this movie looks great. Even, spoiler alert, but like, it's from 1976, crikey. At the end, when Moore takes out Fleischer, with the Lee Enfield, it's brutal. Like Moore's never looked better, I think.
No, I'm gonna say it now. True.
I think this is Moore's greatest non-Bond role, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's up there.
Solid.
You can make a case for it.
Even better than North Sea Hijacking.
Yeah. because that movie bored me to death because he was barely in it. You know.
I like the scene where Moore blasts away at the Blucher as it's about to ram the ship. Cool. He's got like a Gewehr 98 and he's just shooting at this massive impending ship.
It's a fun romp, isn't it?
A couple of other things before we move on. There's a Vickers FB5 pusher plane.
Yes, there is. That's really nice.
Which they find the Blucher with. And the final scene with Lee, it's also seen in... the scene with the pusher plane. It's used to shoot at the plane, but there's a Vickers gun playing the part of a Maxim, and it's a single arch smooth jacket Vickers with a fake conical flash hider added to the blank adapter at the front of the
nice
gun.
Vickers spotting there. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was just the regular old Vickers. Yeah.
Regular
and Marvin
Maxim,
on it again. Marvin just takes it on at the end and holds off the German Kriegsmarine. Like, it's just so good. This is brilliant.
It really is.
Like, you know, and shout out the bit where Lee has to nearly fight that man in the costume, which I called a croc-stume, because it was like a crocodile or an alligator, and it just, I couldn't work out whether it was stop motion or if it was a guy in a suit. But you know, like the old monster movies where they like they sort of really badly animate them like that, and it just took me out of the scene. But it was great. Like, and I think mentioning all these little parts shows you how wild this movie is. It fits everything it can in.
It's some of its parts as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really is. I think a final shout out for me is we've never had a riverboat shootout on the pod yet. A paddle steamer versus a like a little riverboat.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we haven't.
It's so fun. Like it's, it's so hard to describe this movie.
So they, for the film, they built a full size half replica of a German battleship. They built the they acquired the plane, and then they brought in the steamboat as well.
Yeah,
and then they built a whole fort. The German fort.
It gets used like twice.
Yeah, in two like very brief shots, and then there's a homestead set. But there's a bit of scale to it, and I appreciate that. I think it works really well.
Yeah, and I like all the rifles that Lee has in his office.
Yeah, when he opens that door, that's great.
Yeah, it's so nice. Yeah, it's just the Ali Tally might not be fantastic this week because there's nothing really I could really pin that I loved, but like it's so much going on, it's such a rich stew of things that it all really really works, and it's proper boy's own stuff, isn't it? Like it's just great. It really really is. So I think talking of that boy's ownness of it, maybe we should move into favorite scenes. Matt, your favorite scene?
I think mine is Lee on the Maxim at the end of the film. He goes out like a don. He has his wild bunch moment, hosing down the German sailors as they're coming on. And he holds them off until the ship explodes. But if you've never seen this film and you listen to how we've talked about this film, just the various little scenes, it must sound insane.
We do our classic FOF review where we don't 100% review something. This is the thing, we like to leave you hoping that you'll go away and watch the movie. We don't want to just go, right, scene one, scene two, scene three, scene four. There's no point because you can see the movie.
Yeah. You'll be here all day as well.
Exactly.
Well, the episode will be longer than the film.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be quite something. but it's madcap. There's so much going on here.
But yeah, I like that. And again, Lee just looks convincing behind that gun. It's
Lee great. Marvin. Like I've said it before, it's Lee Marvin. You know what you're getting. I think his turn from like serious to comic to bewildered to drunk, like it's all so seamless. Like it's everything you want in a Marvin performance. You've got it here. It's just great.
I also really like the battle on the hill where they attack the column that's moving up. Parts to fix the Blücher.
That was good.
And it's like a long range rifle battle. They open fire at quite a range and cause chaos. And there's a German lieutenant that gets dragged down the hill face first.
Yeah.
There's a bit where it's suggested that an Ascari is going to be decapitated by a sliding sheet of steel that falls off one of the sleds that they're pulling. It's just big scale. And in Moore's autobiography, my word is my bond, he talks about the filming of that scene, and he says they were all stood at the bottom of this hill in a gully, and as he was stood there and he was watching them up at the top of that hill, which is quite a big hill, and they were preparing these two big essentially the like big wheels, I guess you'd call them.
They're like pulling the
large.
They look like those wooden wheels that industrials, like they spool up industrial wire.
Yeah, like a spool. Yeah, like a a cotton reel type. Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah.
So that holds like parts, and they're rolling them towards the Blücher. Anyway, and he realized that they're all stood where this was destined to come rolling down the hill. So he grabbed the radio and he told the director, like, we're all stood here. Like, should we move everyone that isn't needed?
I think we should move.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks, Roger. And
no problem, Matthew.
And they move all the people. And then Roger realizes that they've moved them even closer to where the thing's going to be. And he has to get on the radio again and get them all moved again. But his autobiography is really good. I would recommend it. There's a couple of bits I'll mention later on that are really quite good. But I like that scene. It has a bit of scale. It's an interesting concept of them being on a hill, dragging something, and it causing chaos. Nice little set piece.
No, it really, really is. Every scene in this is well executed. That I don't think there's a weak part to the movie. Well, I might talk about it later, but there's no necessarily weak set pieces. It all gets what it's going for. So my favorite scene this week it has got to be the fight between Flynn and Sebastian. And it's so good. It's funny. It's slapstick. It's Keystone Cops. But it's also quite brutal. Like, it's everything you want in a sort of Western style cowboy fight scene. So the instigating issue is that Sebastian falls in love with Rosa, and he asks for Flynn's hand in marriage, like to give his the daughter's hand in marriage. But the real problem is that Flynn is going to swindle money from Sebastian after they've captured this box of German funds. And Lee starts the fighting by hitting him in the private area, shall we say? And he says, and Rose is like, "How could you hit him there?" And Marvin goes, "Well, he's not the one pregnant," which is fantastic. And it just turns into this proper like bar fight, and you've got Marvin sort of learns that Sebastian was a Queensbury Rules boxer at Eton, and he's like, "Footwork, my boy, footwork," and that comes up a few times. There's some great dialogue in the scene, and it's just very funny. Like, you get a bit where Marvin hits a wooden post, and he's giving it the whole, like, "My hand's all broken," and he's like, "Oh, you sure you want to stop? Like, you should stop now, like, you get while the going's good," type thing. It's just Marvin and Moore sell that really, really well, and I, watching it a few times, I don't think there's many instances where there's stunt doubles. Like, they're doing that. And it's obviously...
Well, in Moore's book, he talks about them rehearsing it for quite a while. And then when they came to do it, Lee was apparently red-eye drunk. Like,
you can see in the film. He's definitely four sheets to the wind.
He was approaching, like, blackout drunk.
You'll expect nothing less.
When they came to do it, Moore essentially had to duck real punches, so he was in essentially a real fight with Lee Marvin.
Marvin's just going for it. Marvin just
He was, apparently. There's lots of anecdotes in Moore's book where he talks about Lee would be, you know, sober one day, and he'd chat to, like, a member of the supporting cast, and be like Pally, and like old friends, exchanging stories, and then you know, he'd come on set and at another point, and he'd be pretty much done, like, sozzled, and
gazeboed.
He'd tell the guy to, like, do one and, like, have a full-blown hateful argument with the dude. How true that is, I don't know, but as I said, Moore's book's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, there's some great anecdotes in it. But it's just it's a scene for me that encapsulates how well Moore and Marvin were cast, and there's a chemistry there that you wouldn't expect. You wouldn't expect Roger Moore, like, you know, this is what, 3 years into his Bond work, coming off of The Saint, you know, being this really sort of a certain way of acting, a little bit Niven-esque, where you're getting more of Moore than you maybe are of a character in certain movies, and you've got Marvin, and on paper you think Marvin and Moore, like, is this going to work?
It doesn't work, yeah.
And then the chemistry is just so well done. And I think the fight scene really shows you, like, there's these two actors who have, you know, Moore's obviously got fight training from Bond and probably The Saint. Marvin's coming from years of Westerns and these rugged roles. And it just brings these two essentially, they're not character actors, but you know what I mean by that. It brings these two powerhouses like into their element, and it's just such a great fight scene. If there's not another scene in this movie that encapsulates how well this movie works, it is that fight scene for me. Cemented like those characters
it's,
for me.
Yeah, it's physical, it's funny, it's very well done. Yeah. I also read Roy Mosley's biography of Moore, and in that he quotes Peter Hunt, the director, and he says, "They were very funny together and liked each other a great deal. They would socialize and get drunk together in the evenings, and although they never had thick heads in the morning," which that might be a little bit of a white lie there, Pia. but Roger really enjoyed his time with him. At one of the press premieres, he said, "I love this gentleman. He brought out one of the best performances I've ever done."
I agree.
Yeah, exactly, and it shows. It really does.
It really, really does. So, moving into final thoughts.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
This is a strange movie to like sum up, but it's part, as I said, Guns and Navarone, part African Queen. But to me, it's like drawing from The Man Who Would Be King, The Wind and the Lion. And then in there, you've got these comedic elements that feel like they could be from Ripping Yarns from the 80s. I mean, I know our audience would know what that is. It's a Terry Jones and Michael Palin. Was it Terry Jones and Palin? Mm-hmm. I think it was.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is this sort of boy's own adventure, sort of like Kipling-esque adventure type TV show.
Yeah, like pastiches of Kipling and stuff.
Yeah, like a post Python. Monty Python's Flying Circus original run, and it's got all that in there, and it just kind of works. Like there's so much in there. It's like a crowd pleasing movie, isn't it? There's something for everyone. There's Moore and Marvin, a great cast. You've got these great set pieces. You've got a cracking fight scene. You've got some good shootouts. There's this whole sort of colonialism of it. The sort of the world's going to change. You know the stakes, or you know how the war's going to change everything.
Yeah,
it's got a lot in there. But then also, I mean, I know we're going to talk about it now, but then also it gets to a point and the stakes just are raised and it becomes a revenge film and you're not expecting it at all.
No, you're
like,
not.
Of course, if
that
you read the book,
changes,
you
just,
are.
Oof.
But about an hour and 40 in, Fleischer and his colonial army, they mass because the war's been declared. And now they know they've got carte blanche to essentially do what they want with minimal repercussions. And also they're going to go and help repair the Blücher. But he sets about Flynn's homestead. When Flynn's away, he doesn't know Flynn isn't there. He's out on an ivory hunt. And in the
he's
process
destroying
of,
the German fort. When they,
destroying
when
the
he
German fort.
Out.
Yeah, so they're destroying his fort while he's destroying theirs. It's like a nice little parallel. But during that sequence, Rose's baby is killed.
Yeah.
Off screen, I might add, it's done quite tastefully. But after that, it becomes a revenge film. And,
yeah,
and then the
it's
last
kind of insinuated that it's thrown into a burning building, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's hard.
You're not expecting
it.
And it
no.
It hits. And it's quite a well-shot sequence, as you say. I agree. And, and from there on, the film is a lot darker.
It is darker. Yeah.
And she's consumed with grief
anger.
And the desire for revenge. And Moore has it in his own way, but he also sees a slightly bigger picture. There's a bit just before he flies off to find the Blücher. He says, once this is over, you need to come back to me, essentially.
That's it.
And she's just not there yet, Roger.
No, she's like
she's
we need
not,
to
she's not ready for that.
Let's get revenge for this baby that we've it's just been taken from us, and then we can think about the future, eh?
Yeah.
You know, and I like that because she grounded that part of the movie there. Cause it still tries the comedic element, but it doesn't do it as much after that sequence. And I was pleased of that. You still get quite a funny scene where it's all the way through essentially Flynn setting up Sebastian to do the stuff he doesn't want to do. Flynn sets up with the Royal Navy for essentially Sebastian to go and put a bomb on the ship. And they all like, and the Royal Navy work out they can bribe Flynn to do what they want with booze, which is hilarious. Just
there's
so great.
Some great bits in Zanzibar where he gets given like a very small glass of gin,
yeah,
Plymouth gin, and he gives the guy a look. It's great.
It's so great.
I love the subtext of his alcoholism all the way through it, and we know that, you know, Lee liked to drink, but you know the scene where Marvin holds the baby and Roger Moore looks physically concerned about Lee doing this. So there's a funny anecdote about that in Roger's book. And he says, I remember being terrified in the scene when Grandpa O'Flynn was to pick up his young grandchild for the first time, as Lee, well known for his hard drinking, was six sheets to the wind and picked up the baby without supporting his head. Let me assure you, my look of concern wasn't purely acting. The boy has been crying like that. Sorry, let me go again. The boy had been crying like no tomorrow. But then suddenly, when Lee picked him up, he stopped. The reason? Lee breathed 200% proof. Lee breathed 200% vodka fumes all over him. I often wonder if there was a 30-something man in Port St. John who had grown up to be an alcoholic.
That's incredible.
Well, yeah.
Marvin is the baby whisperer right there.
You watch that scene, though, and you can see there is a genuine amount of concern when Marvin picks up the baby.
It's great. Like, just get, the anecdotes
thank you for confirming
are making
that, Roger.
The anecdotes are no problem, Matthew. The anecdotes are making this episode for me. It's so great when we get a biography where someone's really gone into detail about their experiences. Because sometimes you read these autobiographies and it's like, and then I did this film, and then I did that film, and there's no in between. But I love that Moore, Holm, and Marvin had really wrote about this movie. You can tell how much they enjoyed it from that. You know, you don't hold on to bad memories; you hold on to good ones. So that, you know, that comes through. But then we come to sort of my issues with it. And they're not major, but I think talking about that tonal shift at the end, the movie feels like it's going to wrap up in a way. But then as a viewer, I was thinking, well, how can you wrap it up? Because so much has happened, but yet not a lot has happened at the same time.
Yeah.
And then this it doesn't shoehorn it, but this whole World War One started, now we need to go and blow up the ship. That element there for me, that's essentially the second half of the movie. And I felt what had been quite this rattling adventure tale was really well paced. I felt that ending dragged just a little bit, just a tiny bit.
That's interesting.
That's minor. It's minor.
I think for me, I felt it was a little bit rushed because of the way that it had been cut.
Rushed
might
be the
word. I know what you mean about dragging. It doesn't have that pace. So compared to the first half of the film, it doesn't have that pace, which it, you know, ambles along nicely. The second part of the film kind of, there's cuts that make it feel just not as well.
Mm. And this is where that 50-minute being cut out, I think, maybe comes into play, where they've had to make an ending off of this much more elaborate ending. And, you know, maybe having a sea battle in there might have helped to explain why they need to go and blow the Blucher up themselves.
And there's some great model work in the film from Derek Meddings. We didn't mention him in production, but he worked on lots of Bond films, Aces High, Joe 90, Thunderbirds.
Wow.
UFO, Stingray. And there's some
Stingray.
Great little...
Da-na-na-na. Can't say it without saying that.
And there's lots of nice little model shots in there when the Blucher cuts the dow in half and a couple of other bits and bobs and it just might have added a little bit of something. It doesn't have to be a big naval battle, but it might have added something.
They kind of get it in there at the start with the really nicely animated start with the credits. They kind of get it in there.
Yeah.
But they could have used stock footage and I wouldn't have minded at all. And I felt like the aerial sequence in the biplane dragged a little bit for me. I felt like it sort of was, I was like, okay, you've done what you need to do now. Like, okay. And then I was just sitting there thinking, Portugal? Matt was like, oh, Portugal were in the war. And Matt was like, no, they weren't, not till 1916. And then that ruined that whole bit for me, Matt. Because I was
sorry, mate.
They're breaking their neutrality.
When I said that, Rob, I did say, but we'll let them off.
You did. And we'll let them off as well, because it's very nitpicky. But equally, whenever do you get Portuguese representation in a war movie? You just don't. Yeah. So the fact they're in there is something.
I mean, for me, it's an enjoyable film. And it's, you could sit down expecting one of these colonial Africa romps, and then it just changes into a revenge picture. And I think that elevates it a little bit. Because a lot of the reviews I read, one of them is quite scathing. It described Lee as being like a W.C. Fields character that's gone native. Just too slapstick. And I don't think so.
I think Lee
plays it really well. I think Moore gives a great performance. I think Holm gives a great performance. And I think Parkins does as well as Rosa. And my one critique of the film is the decision to have Moore take the killing of Fleischer at the end, because Rosa is about to, and then Moore grabs the rifle off her and there's a mad minute into Fleischer as he's trying to climb out of the
room. It's brutal, isn't it? He rattles him off. I thought that was Moore's arc of him redeeming himself and not being there at the time. I thought that was what it was.
Yeah, that's probably. It's just a minor thing that
I get it.
Well, you've deprived a grieving mother of the revenge that she wanted.
True.
So you can look at it a couple of different ways.
But then I like the sort of classic cliche villain thing where you're like, there's no way he could have survived the explosion. And then you see a hand come out of the water and I'm like, he's back. I love that cliche. I absolutely adore it. I love it. I thought it was so great to see it. And I think, and I personally, as I said earlier, I think it's one of Moore's best non-Bond roles.
It's interesting to see that African aspect of the Great War, which rarely depicted on screen. Although I wouldn't show this to someone and go, this is what the war in Africa was like.
No, it's not. It's not nowhere near a good representation of it.
It's, again, one of those instances where a film is set against the backdrop of war.
It's inspired by, isn't it?
I knew, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I knew from reading the synopsis, whenever we'd done Roger Moore or Lee Marvin films, and I'd gone, oh yeah, they were in Shout the Devil. I hadn't seen it. And having read the synopsis, I thought, that would actually be quite interesting for us to cover.
Mm.
And now that we have, turns out I was right.
It's a really interesting film. It's very enjoyable. Like as we said at the start of the show, it's on YouTube. It's out there to watch. I think it's on DVD as well. Maybe a Blu-ray knocking around here and there. It's a fun one. Like stick it on a Sunday afternoon after your roast or after your Sunday lunch. Like it's a perfect film for that, really. I think you can't go wrong with it. I think that was 1976's Shout at the Devil. Please join us next week when we go through Ridley Scott's Napoleon. It's already having some controversy, shall we say, from Ridley Scott's
interviews and such. Yeah,
press releases and interviews this week. Yeah, saying you weren't there. Do you know you weren't there? How do you know that didn't happen? Which I think is interesting. And we'll put that to the test next week. Will it be a hit or will it be shit? We'll find out next week, folks.
We will.
When we review Napoleon. So stick with us again on Fighting on Film for your war movie reviews. You can find the entire back catalogue of Fighting on Film on fightingonfilm.com. Start from episode one, see how fast you can catch up. Also, if you'd like to, join the Patreon. We've got some interesting things coming up in December. That's the best place at the moment to keep abreast of that. Patrons, keep an eye out. There'll be an announcement dropping very, very soon for our December output. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys. Bye.
Catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.